The Media Beat with David Terechuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. David has his own website, which is mediabeat.us. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we love having him in here on a Friday morning to take a look at the media and what the Media Beat has been doing. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you. Checking in, as usual, from the media capital of the world, New York City. Checking in with the always sharp Marshall Miles, of course.
There's so many different avenues we can go out on. I want to go out on one, though, and see what you think. And that's what's going on with Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg. I mean...
Sure, absolutely. The Wall Street Journal has been on Facebook, if you like, and on it in the sense of on its tail constantly for quite a while now. The most recent evidence of the very dedicated work is a set of documents, essentially. It's a Wall Street Journal series, which is based entirely on internal documents from Facebook itself. The overall conclusion of it is hardly surprising. We've known for some time the facts that the Wall Street Journal's relating to us are well established. It's just that what seems to be clearer than ever is that Facebook knows its own faults and is not doing anything about them. That's the main message. In fact, the journal itself says that Facebook knows in acute detail, interesting phrase that its platforms are riddled with flaws that cause people harm, often in ways that only the company itself fully understands. And yet, of course, as so often with Mark Zuckerberg's company, the top management, i.e. Mark Zuckerberg himself, in essence, isn't doing anything about it. We've known for instance, more than 2 years now about Facebook's, I mean, it yielded to criticism and acknowledged that its platform needed certain improvements, especially when it came to the sort of climate of dissent and angriness and sheer bloody-mindedness in many ways. Do you remember back in, I think it was 2018 or getting into 2019, when Zuckerberg announced a kind of shift of aim with Facebook, making it less of a, if you like, the town square, free for all, and instead sort of stress the Facebook's capacity for connections and making bonds between, in essence, more family and friends type of closeness rather than an open public square. As a result, it was thought, or it was certainly promoted this way by Facebook, that it would get to be a healthier place and less angry. In fact, what the Wall Street Journal reveals through these documents is that exactly the opposite has happened. And in recent time, it's become even more clear that Facebook has just gotten to be an angrier place and angrier and angrier. The top management is reviewing various fixes for this that have been promoted by their own staff members. But the top management itself is saying, no, we're not going to change it because the algorithms that are at play here to promote that end up promoting objectionable or harmful content are the ones that keep people engaged. It's that old argument about Facebook that we give people what they want and that's how we hold on to them, and by feeding them a diet essentially that makes people angrier and angrier, you get more users or you retain more users, and That, of course, is what lies at the heart of most thoughtful people's objections to Facebook's way of operating. It's basic business model, in other words.
Absolutely, and a great job by the newspaper, and they've been covering this now for a long time, several years.
Yeah, absolutely, and there are other sections of their report which are worth commending too. The fact that this is something that I don't think many people did know, that while Facebook has said that it's entirely democratic, it sort of allows its users to speak on an entirely equal footing with the elites of politics, culture, and journalism, and so on, and its standards apply to everyone. Well, in fact, there's been a coterie, if you like, a whole phalanx of millions of people that Facebook regards as VIPs, and they're exempt from the normal enforcement about bad material or hateful material on the site. And the people in this privileged position abuse their privilege, of course, by posting material that includes harassment and incitement to violence and so on. And that again is something that the company says it wants to tamp down on, but in fact is not.
All right. Well, we've got our call to the post. Should we play it now?
Yeah, because I can actually talk about something in practical terms that is being organized to counter the kind of harmful effects of sites like Facebook. Let's hear the fanfare. Yeah, I want to highlight a media initiative that's dedicated to combating disinformation online. It's a venture that originates across the Atlantic. That won't surprise you. In this case, in Ireland, a country that you know I have a great interest in and I've been based in many times. And quite recently, of course, I've been doing the media beat here from Ireland earlier this year, and I'll be doing it again later this year, Marshall, so we'll look out for that. But this new initiative was launched in Dublin on A Waiting World on United Nations International Democracy Day, in fact, September 15th, from Ireland's great university, Trinity College, Dublin. The college's Shula Democracy Forum, it's named after a benefactor, the philanthropist Dr. Beata Shula, and it's dedicated to applying Trinity's world-renowned capacity for humanities research to the big questions that bedevil our democracy and the media. The launch was actually given voice by a notable multimedia journalist in Ireland, Mark Little. Well worth noting, Mark Little. He spoke on the theme of media for humanity. What a nice idea. It's a neat title, echoing notable and very welcome institutions like Habitat for Humanity. Mark Little's own practical efforts are well worth notice. He's a journalist and a social entrepreneur, if you like, both combined, and he runs a service from Dublin, but fully international in scope. It's dedicated to flagging for all of us, and not just flagging, but countering twisted information, bad information, misinformation, disinformation, whatever you like to call it, when it surges across the internet. And rather intriguingly, he and his colleagues are trying to take on this industrial size scale of the untruth business, if I can call it that, by having it monitored, in part at least, by artificial intelligence. It's a case, I guess, of setting a thief to catch a thief, in the old saying, though in this case it's almost like a case of getting robots to catch robots. I'm oversimplifying here, but in actual fact, Little's work is a strategic blend, if you like, of human judgment, of course, because you've got to have human judgment to the fore here, along with artificial intelligence, for the benefit of us all, for us media consumers, for policymakers, for ordinary citizens. It's using technology to crawl across our bandwidths and detect and counter dubious information in text, audio, or video content too, and flag it and rate it with the low score that it deserves. But it's using tech, but of course it's programming that powers this search function. It has to be based, and it is based, on sound, well-informed human judgment. So I commend Mark Little's work in Ireland and across the world.
Well, hopefully, I hate to say this, but social media is such a problem for not only world, for people in the world, but for world governments. And it's amazing how out of control it is. And it really, you know, with the technology that's available out there, things like this don't have to come to where they've come. They just don't. It's just, once again, nobody thought that social media companies could make money. Well, you take a look at Google, take a look at Yahoo, take a look. These are big, multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar companies now.
Yeah, there are enormous forces in our democracy, and they need to be reeled in, and that essentially that is what's happening now in many parts of the world. But it is a big challenge to democracy, and the democratic institutions need to take into account these very, very different ways now. I mean, we thought we had trouble with talk radio and the 24-hour cable news cycle, but of course everything has got amplified enormously by the worldwide digital revolution, which has put it on an entirely different scale entirely. That's why I call it an industrial scale problem.
And just wait, because once the Starlink system is complete, Starlink will not rely on any Earth-based stations around the world to be able to receive internet service. That is also another thing on the horizon, which is going to be, because no government will be able to actually shut it off.
Starlink is Elon Musk's brainchild, of course, through his SpaceX company. A network of satellite-based internet providers in the sky, as it were. I mean, they've been quite literally out in space. And sure, it's one very determined effort, I think, to escape the confines of national states' control of their own airwaves, if you like. It's not even airwaves anymore. It's the Ethernet writ large, and needs careful watching and careful measures to control its tendency to excess. And if ever there was an individual in charge who has what you might call a tendency to excess, I think Elon Musk pretty well personifies it. Along, of course, with Mark Zuckerberg, who we were talking about just now.
All right, and a very interesting turnabout in our national policy, which has not really been talked about a lot, and that is Russia is no longer target number one as a country we have to defend ourselves against. It seems now the entire focus of the foreign policy is to start to get on top of what's going on with China.
Yeah, it's a shift in American position that's been clear from the Obama time, and in a rather twisted way from Trump as well, who is various denigrations of China. But also Biden is bringing it to more concrete fruition, I think. The New Deal that includes essentially cements an alliance between the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Australia. That's the new element in the mix, in the military mix at least. It's a deal whereby Australia, because of its position in the South Pacific, essentially controlling, or not controlling, but with a huge role to play in the South Pacific area, indicating the broad internationally shared concern about China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific region, and of course it's caused some upset with the United States' traditional allies in Europe, especially this tilt away from concerns in which the opponent seems to be not in every case, but and not for every country in Europe. They don't all share the same feeling, but the broadly shared notions, certainly promoted by NATO, the main transatlantic alliance that links America with Europe, is that the main rival to contain and be wary about and prepare defenses against is Russia. But as you say, the main consideration at work now for the Biden administration and the allies that it's now cultivating is the rising influence of and the rising power, military as well as political and economic, of China. And inevitably, people in Europe are upset. The French, perhaps, more upset than others, because they it all comes down to business very often, doesn't it? And in this case, there's a business deal that's been scuppered. The French were about to sell Australia a whole lot of submarines, conventional submarines, and in comes this new American arrangement whereby, in alliance with America, Australia, because of their alliance with America, Australia is going to get nuclear submarines, nuclear powered. We rush to make clear, nuclear powered submarines, that is, not submarines carrying nuclear weapons. But it changes the balance entirely, and not surprisingly, and not for the first time, the French feel that they're being snubbed and kept out, and in this case, having their economic arrangements messed with by the United States.
Well, when I first heard the story, I mentioned on air that don't you worry about it. At the end of this, when this deal's all done, the United States is going to do something to make France feel a little bit better. It's just it's part of the behind the scenes political game. I don't know whether it's going to be perfect, but you know that the other shoe is going to drop there somehow.
Well, America has no desire to alienate European nations, least of all France. And you're probably right. There'll be ways of soothing the ruffled feathers of the French. But it goes a lot deeper than just the amour propre, if I can use a French phrase about the French. It's a very distinct sense that the French have that they are not really taken into account fully. I mean, this particular spat is about hardware, but in fact, it's intelligence most of the time that causes the tensions, and then people who are kept out of the knowledge loop, if you like. There is already an intelligence alliance at work, which covers the Pacific as well as the rest of the world, and is tilting in its intent, at least, towards the Pacific very, very decidedly. It's known as the Five Eyes alliance. It's a very practical alliance, and it's very shadowy because it is all about the intelligence services. But it's the intelligence services of very particular countries. Again, the list is hardly surprising, but it's five countries, of course, Five Eyes, five sets of eyes. It's the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And of course, they're all English-speaking countries, and the French have always thought that, hey, this is very exclusionary as far as we're concerned. So, you know, this latest spat is just another sort of scratch on the old wound.
And let's talk what's going to happen tomorrow. Once again, the right-wing rally, which is being organized to support the people who invaded the Capitol.
Yeah, barriers are up again in D.C. You've probably seen the images. The barriers that were put up, rather like bolting the door after the shutting the door up, the barn door after the horse is bolted on January the 6th. Barriers and protective security of all kinds put up after the invasion of the Capitol, and those barriers have gone up again in concern that there would be another attack on the against the security or what is now, one hopes, a much improved security of the Capitol, arranged by both the D.C. police and the Capitol police. All the statements being made are suggesting that there's no perceived and credible threat to the Capitol itself this time. But of course, that doesn't mean that security can be in any way relaxed. It's not going to be relaxed. I think it's going to be a rather a tense event tomorrow. But yeah, it's yet more evidence that. That the idea that the Biden administration got its victory in last year's election by nefarious means, and that it was all election fraud, and Biden is not a rightful president, is still bubbling away, and people who believe that are still prepared to show up in considerable numbers, and make the democracy threatening noises that they will doubtless make this weekend.
You know, the scary part of this, David, is that a full 24% of the Republican voting that they did a survey, actually, there's only 24% of Republicans who voted who actually think it was a legitimate election. That's a scary figure.
Absolutely, yeah, and you know this translates in practical terms. We know to some 70 plus million people who voted for Trump, and as you say, a sizable chunk of them who believe that they were cheated, and that's a very disagreeable and threatening state of affairs for any country, most of all for a country which is predicated really upon. On a public perception of its leaders. I mean, that's the essence of democracy, isn't it? Do you trust the people in charge or do you not? I mean, I've reported from enough autocratic countries, totalitarian countries, where I know what it's like to live in a country where you just don't trust your leadership. And it's embedded in the national psyche not to trust our leadership. And to see that gaining such a hold in this country is very distressing indeed.
It's very strange political times here for Republicans and for Democrats as they move forward. One final thing, any sign at all that the Democrats have any chance of pleasing their more conservative fellows and getting this reconciliation budget through?
We have two chambers, one very, very finely balanced, the Senate, and the other chamber on the Capitol, the House of Representatives, where the margin's a little bigger. But there are, as you say, Democrats who don't want to go along with it, and the Biden administration can't afford to offend too many of them. A small handful could mean that the massive initiatives that are proposed by the Biden administration, and we must never underestimate the importance of these extraordinarily far-reaching measures that are being proposed here in terms of infrastructure and in terms of economic measures overall, to use an overused word, but of a very progressive nature, and to get them through, the Biden administration has got to do an awful lot of dealing, wheeling and dealing. That's what happens on Capitol Hill. And whether they can pull it off in both chambers is still a very open question. I'm a journalist. I report on events. I try not to predict them. But I'm extremely cagey about making any assessment assessment whether or not the Biden administration can actually pull this one off.
Well, it's all I can say is every week that goes by, the world has gotten to be such a small place that when we talk about the media beat, David, it really encompasses the entire globe with what's going on. It seems like every country has its own problems, and then you've got China sitting there hoping to take advantage of it all.
Well, I often think of the Chinese Communist Party's senior leadership leaning back at moments like this and saying to themselves, "Well, we're glad we're not democracy." but that's too cynical a way to take it. The job of the media is to keep the public informed, and I still think, rather like the Irish initiative I was referring to earlier, the more you get people to understand what's happening, the better chances exist for democracy to actually work. I remain that naive. Can you believe it?
I don't think it's naive. I think it's I think it's hopeful, and I think that you know what, we all have to feel that way one way or the other. That we can get back to a semblance of what we were. Never, you know, the horse is out of the barn, the cows are out of the field, whatever. But hopefully, we can get back to some sort of a sensibility where Americans can trust their government again.
Well, I hope so. The pendulum always does swing, after all.
David, always great to speak to you. We'll speak to you next week.
Indeed.
David Taraschuk with The Media Beat. And, of course, David's website is themediabeat.us, themediabeat.us. You can also hear David on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on The Media Beat with David Taraschuk.